This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details.
Tom Latcham on FUBAR Radio.
Athletics in crisis following report into Russian drug cheating. Russia said to have conducted state-sponsored doping on an industrial level. Sebastian Coe under pressure amid calls for him to ban the country from future events. And British athletes are queuing up to demand the IOC strips cheating Olympic winners of their medals. The reason I'm talking like this is I've got a Sky Sports presenting legend in the house alongside me today as my co-presenter, Mr. Matthew Lorenzo. Hello, Mr. Matthew Lorenzo.
Oh, good morning to you.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Seemed like an apt time to do this Sky Sports News thing with the front pages.
Yeah, but you
being
actually
as
had headlines
are.
There. But normally it would be, Shearer has groin strain. Yeah, we're on the other side, 9/11's taking place. So it was all a bit dramatic.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah,
good man. Thanks for joining us. What are you doing at the moment? It's nice to have you in. I mean, you're editing a film currently?
I'm producing a film, which is different to directing one or even doing any sort of work on it. I mean, I was produced when I was at Sky, ITV and various other places for a while, and I didn't realise that all I had to do basically was come along, read out loud and sit next to somebody very glamorous and go home, being relatively well paid for it, while somebody else produced me. And now the boot is firmly stuck on the other foot, and you do everything as a producer. So I'm running around. I'm not used to it. Don't like it at all.
Not the glamorous life. You're a glamorous man.
Oh, thank you.
And the film is on, you should explain, is on Bobby Moore.
Yeah, it's a feature doc on Bobby Moore, the sort of thing that they did with Senna. And it's coming out in the cinemas next May. It's 90 minutes, I think, which is a fitting duration. And I'm doing it because I grew up with him. My dad and he were great mates, and I followed in my dad's footsteps. I mean, Bobby used to come around to the house and have cups of tea, and he was the England captain at the time, so it made me the envy of my mates. And I had all the contacts, so it was a fairly easy thing to fall into. And I rang Pelé's agent a week after we decided to do it, and Pelé's agent said, he says he'll do it and for nothing. And
wow.
You don't often get Pelé and for nothing in the same sentence. In fact, we've done him twice, and everybody else has put their hands up and fallen into line, so it's good. And one of the issues is that Bobby was pretty much shunned by the people who owed him so much towards the end of his life, and I want to sort of redress that balance if at all possible.
And do we know why he was shunned? Do you get to the bottom of why he was shunned in your movie?
It's not so much telling us our theory. We just put forward various theories, and you can make your own mind. I think the most dominant thing was that the FA at the time were a bunch of old duffers, and petty jealousy came into play. And that Bobby would walk into a room, they would be jealous of his presence and authority, and they snubbed him. He wrote applying for a role within the England setup, not the manager's job, but just, I can help out, I've got the experience. He probably had a bit of tongue-in-cheek when he said it, and didn't get a reply to the letter. And I think that's one factor. The other one is that if you follow his career, Ron Greenwood was his manager at West Ham, and they didn't really see eye to eye. On the morning of the World Cup final, he hadn't signed his latest deal with West Ham. He actually wanted to leave West Ham and go somewhere to earn a few bob or a title. And he hadn't signed his contract. And Alf Ramsey was aware of the fact that if he wasn't a league player, he couldn't play in the World Cup, so he put them in a room, bashed their heads together, and got Bobby to sign. But that was the sort of problems he had with Greenwood.
Right.
And if you follow all the way along the line, Greenwood becomes England manager at the time when Bobby's professional life hit a nadir. So the call never came.
When did Ron Greenwood become the manager?
I think it was, don't get me on them.
Ish.
I think it was 77.
Right. I'm kind of trying to think about the shoplifting claim. It wasn't shoplifting, was it? It was a theft claim and stuff like that. It wasn't linked to that.
Another theory, because he never actually cleared his name for what he got done for nicking a bracelet in Bogota just before the World Cup. And it was fairly obvious that it was a put-up job designed, one, to get money out of him, and two, to unsettle England, who were hot favourites to win the 1970 World Cup. So he spent 4 days under arrest. And although he was exonerated and released to play football, he spent years trying to clear his name and never actually managed it.
And I mean, you talk about how they were jealous of his, the FA were jealous of Bobby Moore's status, I suppose. Can you imagine how they would have dealt with David Beckham?
Well, that's a good parallel. We're trying to get David into the film, but I spent 6 months banging in the wall. I think I'm going to try and confront him face to face at this game he's doing at Old Trafford. Anyway, yeah, David Beckham was the Bobby Moore of his day. Bobby Moore was actually a better player and achieved more. He won a World Cup, for example. And yet Beckham, as we know, is a global superstar with 100 million in the bank. It's sad, really.
Although some of the parts and all that, I mean, it was a pretty good squad, wasn't it? The 66 squad, whereas David Beckham, you could argue never quite had such a strong and impressive squad around, of players around him.
Yeah, that's true.
And he did sort of single-handedly get us to was it the World 2000?
Well, the free kick against Greece.
Exactly,
it was incredible. Yeah, great player. But there were other good players, and England haven't really performed. And we don't actually go into it too much in the film because that would be a different documentary. But there's been 50 years of pain, and I reckon part of the reason is we haven't looked to people like Bobby Moore and his legacy, overused word, to help out the kids, the younger players of today.
In
and
what
they can
way?
Still do
in
that.
What way?
Well, you just look at his demeanour, the way he carried himself, the way he played the game, his responsibility. He just took on things, kept things to himself. He never sold his paper to a tabloid. He never got caught with a page three bird anywhere. You know, he was a great footballer. the essence of Bobby Moore was laid down to him at West Ham by Malcolm Allison, another great coach. And he basically said, always know what you're going to do with the ball before it comes to you. So Moore, although he wasn't the fastest in the world, always had time. And little diktats like that. Frank Lampard still does it. He's in the film. Both Lampards are. And Frank Lampard Jr. says he too came round to his back garden. It had more of an effect on Frank Lampard than it did on two left feet me. But he used to tell him, always be looking over your shoulder. We've got this fantastic bit of footage. You don't realise it until you look out for it. But Lampard is practically running blind. He's always looking over his shoulder, blah, 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 blah. And he says he learnt it off Bobby Moore.
In many ways, that's how I play hockey.
Really?
maybe
I couldn't
not,
play football, it was no good. They used to make me play rugby, and my war cry was not in the face.
Yeah, I stopped, and all the lads started getting bigger than me, age about 13, 14, and you were doing handoffs to the face. I was like, oh, I don't want to play this anymore, it hurts. But this is actually a. Have you seen Ronaldo?
No, yet. I was reading about it today. I saw the very classy trailer there is for it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait to see it. It sounds like it's going to be absolutely fascinating. But is your movie in that sort of vein of. You know, looking at, I mean, there's been a recent sort of spate, probably not the right word, it makes it sound like a crime wave, but you know, a sort of trend for doing movies that are documentaries about famous people's lives. You had Amy, Senna, and Ronaldo now, and then obviously yours. Is it going to be a similar sort of feel to the movie?
Well, when you say in that vein, I think you got the word right for Ronaldo.
That's what I can't wait to see. All his friends like laughing at him, and then him saying stop now, and then them stopping laughing. I can't wait to see that. That sounds hilarious.
And he describes his agent as the Ronaldo of agents. You know, it's now a new adjective. It'll be a fascinating film. I'd like to see it, and they keep drawing on this rivalry with Messi, which he keeps denying is there. But that would be good. And there is a vogue for sports films that Senna started. There was Miracles, I believe in Miracles, the Nottingham Forest story, which I've seen. It's terrific.
Is it?
Yeah, it's great fun. I mean, even if you don't know what happened, it's a lovely story. Clubs in it and a bunch of ragamuffins end up winning the European Cup twice. So that's lovely. Ours is different. It's, you know, the glory bits and great football and whatever, but there are elements to Bobby Moore which we reveal for the first time. He only ever spoke to his wives. He had two of them, and both of them are in the film. And, you know, the emotional part of it, which is pretty much the second half of the film, the second half of his life, challenging. I dare you to keep from blubbering or for biting a knuckle. It's very emotional stuff, but it's better. There's depth to the film off the back of that.
A bold claim. Oh, I can't wait to see it.
Oh, don't you worry about that.
Matt Lorenzo, thank you very much. Stay with us. Coming up later today, we've got author and journalist Jen Wiley going through the papers on, obviously, the Olympic Russian doping scandal will feature very heavily in that. We'll also have an interview with Green Party peer Jenny Jones, who will be coming into the studio, and we'll have business with Matt Haycox. But first, we'll play one of Matt's songs. Bit of Rolling Stones, I reckon. Time waits for no one. It's Fubar Radio. It's 10:13. It's Tom Latchman. It's 10:20. I'm here with my co-presenter for the day, Matthew Lorenzo, and also joining the studio second week in a row by Jen Wiley, who last week got taken to task over her book on Rita Ora by my co-presenter last week, Gail Porter. So I said, come back in again, and you won't. And
I promise you, I want to interrupt. I want to get into. No, you can't listen to her at all. Go away. Come back next week.
Not again, you promise.
Hopefully, Matt Lorenzo is going to be nice. Going to be nicer and less heavy on you. But I can't. I can make no guarantees. But he seems to be somewhat more sedate, although he's just had a coffee. So who knows? Jen, you've been looking over the papers. What are the front pages saying? There's mostly the big story in town is this Olympic doping scandal that Russia have been conducting, isn't it?
Right. It's a huge story, and it's actually an incredible story, these revelations. I don't know. It's fascinating. I can't wait to see what happens. Obviously, the Russians have been messing around with drug tests for a long time, probably much longer than we know. Mm. And interestingly, now we're like sort of 3 years behind just finding out what they were doing in the lead up to the 2012 Olympics. I'm really glad we found out. They're probably much further ahead now. But I certainly hope to see something happen. I think that they should be banned from Rio.
Matt, is this a surprise?
No, not really. the trouble, someone like Lord Coe has just become, you know, the head of athletics. It's worse than a surprise because he's having to maintain that it was a surprise to him. And he was deputy to the guy that's just been put under the charges for 8 years. So, you know, there'll be tongues wagging about whether he knew it or not. Mm. And I think the real crime here is that anybody who finished second in 2012... you know, deserves the gold medal now, as we suspect, and probably won't get one. And even if they do, they don't get the glory of winning it at the games themselves.
No.
Not fair.
Maybe they should have taken more drugs.
Just open it up. Everybody can take drugs and we're all back on the level playing field.
To be honest, I have thought that in the past. You know, it's like we want people to jump the furthest and run the fastest. You know, if people take drugs and do that, I mean, they're going to reach a certain point of peak jump or peak run, aren't they? Even if they are taking drugs. So, you know.
Open it up and let everyone do them.
It's one way of looking at it.
It's a horrible thought, but it could work.
But it's one way of looking at it. I mean, and I guess that. It is now, do you think, athletics dead? Is athletics dead as a contest?
No, it's tainted. And I think the majority of athletes don't take drugs, despite the temptations. My belief on that, as I'm sure they would corroborate, is that it has to be a level playing field, and you have to know yourself that you've done it yourself. And we've only, you know, those that get caught, it's really not worth... Not so much the ban, it's the public ridicule. But anyway, I don't think we do it. I think the Russians did, and I think it's a legacy of the Cold War on the East Germans and all that sort of stuff. And I would throw them out, although politically that would be too costly, I think, in view of the fact that other things that are going on with them around the world.
It's typical Russia, and in a way, you know...
typical Russia.
But in a way, I kind of... I'm not condoning drug cheating at all, but you kind of got to admire the way Russia go about their business, and they don't give two hoots what anyone else thinks about it. They are going, no, we're going to do this, and we're going to be the best at this running and whatever, and we're going to take on them, and we're going to ignore the West. And in a way, they're kind of like a Bond villain, aren't they? You know, they're just like, I don't care. I'm just going to annoy people, but that's what we're going to do because that's who we are. It's kind of... admirable? No? You're looking at me blankly like it's not admirable.
It's not admirable. It really annoys me, actually. And I feel like now, like over the past few years, they've just been getting away with everything. Like, move into Ukraine, people get upset, but they get away with it. They've just been, you know, human rights abuses. Mm. Well, they're horrible, but no one's really doing anything about it. I mean, I know there are sanctions and a few things are happening, but I'd like to see them get a bit of comeuppance. And, I mean, maybe this is... this is our chance. The rest of the world can say, finally, no, we're going to do something about this.
Russia are a strange case, aren't they? Because they could have been an incredible world superpower had they not have been so bloody-minded, I suppose, or gotten in. If they'd have gone one way rather than the other, they probably could, you know, they could be like China in terms of their power and standing on the world, on the world sort of stage, but actually the way they behave makes them sort of pariahs, and who took that decision and when, and it's a funny way to go.
I'm sure that the general public in Russia aren't too happy about it, but and as we know, that it doesn't matter how happy they are, they don't get the choice. I just know people that won't care about anything what's going on in the world or in athletics, but they'll be incredibly upset about how they rigged the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah. Did they?
Yeah, when? Your votes please Armenia, and you'll find Armenia have always got the Russians in there. Your votes
that's the whole Europe, that's the Eurovision Song Contest. It's not just Russia, is it? They all do it. We've just not been clever enough to get any friends across Europe that vote for us.
You could put a decent song out, that might help.
That might help. Well, the last one that won was Katrina and the Waves, wasn't it? And I mean, was that a great song? I don't know. I'm not sure. Simon Barnes in the Mail says that he doesn't believe that Seb Coe has got the ability to reform athletics. Do you agree with him, Matt?
I don't really know. I admire Seb Coe. I think he's done brilliantly well, and he's a very good politician, which probably is another way of saying he's very crafty and can get away with things. I think anybody would be in trouble here. Who do you trust? I think Coe's record is more more admirable than most, but I just think the fact that he's been the deputy to a guy that's been arrested for 8 years it goes against him. But anyway, to reiterate, I think it would be tough for anybody to get hold of this one because it goes beyond sport. It goes into politics and world wars and, you know, invading Ukraine and bringing down airliners and the rest of it.
Do you reckon that he had... Because he could have been London Mayor, and the Tories said, you know, do you want to be our London Mayor? And he said, no, thanks. He probably could have been in the Cabinet right now if he'd wanted to be. But he went down athletics route. For whatever reason, he did that. Loves athletics. I wonder if he expected or anticipated. He was probably thinking, oh, you know, we head of athletics. It's a fairly easy ride because it's athletics. Everyone loves athletics. And he's found himself in a bigger scandal than if he had been in the Tory Cabinet.
Well, I think athletics is his thing. He was a great athlete, and it's good that he's followed up and he can now actually attempt to pull the strings. I think it's a very difficult job, and I feel it's a bit like George Bush. I mean, he was doing fine until 9/11, and there's that fantastic footage of his aide telling him while he was reading stories, holding the book upside down to a bunch of primary school kids, and it takes him about 2 minutes to work it out. You know, I mean, maybe it's a bad comparison to draw, but you can only feel for Seb that he was sitting there thinking, I finally cracked it, and then a couple of months later, he's writing the doodah.
Hmm. And on other front pages, the Daily Mail does an incredible bit of investigative journalism, yet somehow manages to be incredibly dull at the same time. 6,000 FOIs to find out fat cat spending. We don't really need to go into that. And what's the Sun saying, Jen?
Oh, you're not going to talk about it at all. No one else is talking about it, which is unfortunate because it is a really good story.
I mean, 6,000 FOIs. Who did that? Who does that? I mean, that is
huge amount of work.
Given that I used to be the TV editor of the News of the World, and so did you, Miss Wiley, where we sort of go, oh, someone's going into the jungle, how much is it, they're getting paid, $200,000. That's the level of journalism that we used to show sometimes on that. I certainly did. This is an incredible bit of journalism, but it's very dull. So we don't need to sort of dally on that. But what does the Sun say, which is more interesting, I think?
Yeah, this is a great story too. So some of the bomb detectors being used in Sharm el-Sheikh are fakes, based on the design of these British fraudsters, which... I don't think you'd call that irony, but it does have like sort of a weird symmetry, as you pointed out earlier. So
they're basically like, what are they? They're something golf. They're used for golf or something, for like measuring balls or something. And basically, something like that. And these guys sold them to basically a foreign company. Golf ball finders. That's what they're, novelty golf ball finders. They don't find golf balls at all, and they're just empty shells with an aerial on them, and they've been sold as bomb detectors around the world, which is absolutely appalling, by the way, and they got jailed for a long time and that sort of stuff. But it's a weird symmetry that they popped up in Sharm el-Sheikh, not keeping British people safe as they get onto planes back.
Well, not keeping people safe as they seemingly go into resorts and hotels, I think, is more what these are being used for. But still, the assumption is if you're going through a barrier or a gate and someone is seemingly checking for an explosive device, that device that is checking might actually work. So it just actually, for me, it just raises even more questions about security in general in the area.
There's been a lot of snobbery, hasn't there, about people going to Sharm el-Sheikh. I mean, Richard Littlejohn today writes about how, oh, if you do go to these areas, then what can you expect? I always holiday in America, ignoring the fact that actually it's quite expensive to go to America and a lot of people don't have a great deal of money and want to go. I mean, is there something in that that perhaps, Matt, that we shouldn't be going to places like Sharm el-Sheikh, frankly?
Who's that horrible woman who used to be in the Sun and the Mail?
It could be any of them.
It could be any of them. Sports Katie...
Oh, Katie Hopkins, who's now at Mail Online.
Yeah, it was just, why do they take her on? Because it riles people, and that's not a good enough excuse. But anyway, her latest slant on it is that it's your fault if you're going for a cheap holiday. What do you expect? You know, she's just a horror. And I'd like to go on about the Mail Online. If you read their comments page, it makes you worried about sharing the country with half the people that write them. I mean, they must be writing them from Brampton. They're just morons. There you go.
But they do make for fun reading sometimes. Well, actually, what I find with these comments is they're often, weirdly, the Mail Online comments, they're really sort of pro-gay rights, which you wouldn't think at all. You know, sometimes they're sort of, so the Guardian ones are all sort of right-wing, because then they just go on there to troll people, and then on the Mail Online, they're slightly left-wing anyway. We'll come up with, we'll cover some more stories shortly, we'll play a song. Jen, bit of Arcade Fire you've asked for,
yeah? Yeah, because I'm Canadian, I just felt this weird sense of responsibility to suggest a Canadian band, and I do love them, and I love this song.
Have you seen them live?
No, I have not. Yeah, I've tried in London, but I always miss the tickets.
Quite boring. 10:31, FUBAR Radio.
We'll be right back.
10:37 here on Fubo Radio. I'm coming up in the show. We've got Jenny Jones, the Green Party peer, and a business section. But I'm still joined in the studio by Jen Wiley, who's an author and journalist, my old colleague, who's written a book about Rita Ora, which links into one of the stories we're going to talk about in a minute. And my co-presenter for the day, Matt Lorenzo, who's basically done everything when it comes to sports presenting and is now making a film on Bobby Moore. So yes, he's still here. So we're getting like some lighter stories now. Matt, the one story that you particularly liked, and I don't know what this is about you, it's about a Countdown winner. Tell us about it.
Well, it's not really light, but you can laugh at it. There's a guy who was former Countdown champion who wrote a book, and a woman had the temerity to write a not too favourable review. So he found out who she was via Facebook and various other online devices, found out where she lived and what she did for a living, and travelled 500 miles with a bottle, which he then tried to smash over her head as she stacked shelves in a supermarket. Now, that bit's not very funny, but
we've all done it.
Blimey, you might have felt like doing it.
But yeah, we've all wanted to track down our critics, maybe not glass them, but it
that
would be amazing to confront
extremity.
People.
Well, have you ever, Matt, when you've been presenting, have you ever had criticism? You must have had critics.
I used to get it in my ear the whole time.
No, but I mean from punters, not from your bosses. But I mean, were you presenting in times of Twitter? Because that's the real, where people are really horrible, yeah, and it's in real time as well.
I use Twitter because my agent told me to use Twitter, and everybody has to have a profile. And the thing about Twitter, there should be a block on it after 11 o'clock at night, because you really get vociferous after an evening in the public house, and you can say things that you don't really mean. But I mean, the funniest one that happened to me, I used to present ITV's football, and the London match was usually Crystal Palace. And I remember we did the show, and I said, well, that's it, we'll see you next week, blah, blah, blah. And everybody was packing. I said, hang on, lads, just before you go, roll back on VT, because I think I saw something at the Homesdale end. So they froze on the crowd there at Crystal Palace. And sure enough, there was a bloke holding up a tea towel sized poster on which was written, Matt Lorenzo, you know shit. Now, I could concur with him on many areas, especially football, but the fact that this bloke hated me so much that he was getting arm lock for 90 minutes in the hope the cameras would pick up this poster, that's dedication.
That is dedication. And how have your reviews gone for your Rita Ora book that you've recently produced, Jen? Have they been favourable, or have there been any negative ones?
Actually, they've been entirely favourable.
Wow.
I'm honest.
Have you written them all?
Yeah.
Are they all coming from your IP address?
All three of them are amazing. 5 stars. I was just thinking that one funny thing that happened to me a couple years ago was I messaged some of Talisa Contostablo's.
Yeah.
From the X Factor formerly, some of her high school friends to see if they had any photos. And one of them passed my number on to her, which she then tweeted. And for days, I got thousands of texts and calls going like, leave Talisa alone, yeah. But also...
were they that polite?
Well, some of them were like, hey, so, like, do you know Talisa? Are you, like, Talisa's friend? But I also got a pretty angry call from someone who I actually think was Talisa.
Really? Interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, so we always used to do this when we were sort of doing X Factor backgrounders, you would call it. So when the X Factor or all of them, you know, anyone who these sort of shows, Celebrity Brother, etc., we would do backgrounders where we would check, try and find people who knew people, and they would sell stories. So basically, I would send out lots of messages to Alex Burke when she was up first on X Factor, and I sent them to all of her Facebook friends. Anyway, a few years later, like 2 years ago, I started dating my girlfriend Sophie, and we had each other on friends, added each other as friends on Facebook, and I went to send her a message, and I was like, oh God, and I rang her and I said, go and send me a message. And she was like, well, I'm busy at work. So I said, just go and do it. And she went and sent me a message. And I messaged her in 2007 because she was Alex Burke's mate, saying, do you want to sell a story on Alex Burke? And she'd apparently, she hadn't replied, obviously, and she'd apparently told Alex Burke at the time and said, there's this bloke that's trying. So, you know, if she'd have got in touch then, we could have been going out for 5 more years. You know, 5 more years of wonderful happiness. So there you go.
Her loss,
exactly. So a lesson to everyone out there, you never know. Get in touch with those horrible journalists who get in touch with you. X Factor is obviously part of your book, because Rita Ora is the new judge on there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stories. Well, there's a story in The Guardian today. It's a bit high-minded. You know it's serious when The Guardian's getting in on the act, talking about X Factor, saying that it might be axed.
Yeah, and I think that there's a good chance it might be, actually. Mm. And I hear Sky is interested in potentially taking the X Factor, and ITV will then, their big song contest will be The Voice.
Mm. Do you think there's anything in it?
Yeah, maybe. I
can't see it going to Sky, because I mean, it just the point that Simon Cowell, you know, uses this show for is to sell records. You're not going to sell records on Sky when you're being watched by one man and his dog.
Right, and it still obviously makes a fortune, the program. Mm. Even, I mean, it could go down probably much lower in terms of viewers, and it would still make a ton of money, I think. Mm. But I don't know, it is dying a bit of a death, isn't it? I think, like, Simon Cowell, you can tell he just cannot be bothered. He can't even, like, fake it anymore. Mm. People aren't really, they're not loving it.
Well, I think, like, you can tell as well that they're desperate, because they just do things and then axe them. You know, they'll come up with a feature, it doesn't work, they'll axe them. Matt, in your experience as a presenter, or having worked in television, does that sort of behaviour strike you as something that people do when they're desperate?
What, appear on X Factor?
No. No, you're not that desperate yet, Matt. But no, in terms of, you know, so producers will increasingly come up with sort of harebrained ideas for the sake of, you know, because if ratings are falling or whatever, and they go, and that shows panic. Is that something you've ever experienced?
Well, I don't know about panic, but I've been at the helm, or at the hands of bad producers. And if you're young and inexperienced, you don't really know, so you just obey. And I think any advice for anybody on the telly or doing anything where they have a producer is to fight it out with them, or at least argue with them, because you can end up in a lot of trouble. I didn't end up in trouble, but I ended up losing a good gig at ITV because I followed my producer's diktats. Basically, I was hired for, I don't know, just ad-libbing and wandering off the script. And then when I did the World Cup for ITV in 1994, they gave me scripts and I stuck to them, and I turned into a boring type person, even more boring than I am now, and it all ended horribly. So my advice regarding producers is just, you know, you're part of a team, don't allow them to use you as a puppet.
Will, stop telling me what to do. He's always telling me what to do, Will. I must ignore him. I must listen to him less. Jen, do you want to stick around? You've got to go?
Yeah, I would. No, I sure.
Stick around. We're going to talk some more stories. We'll play another song. One of yours, what? You wanted a Rita Ora song?
Yeah, I wanted a Rita Ora song because I like this song, and because I think that Rita is really talented and undervalued, and
she's a right grumpy old
appreciate
sod.
Her music.
She's a right grumpy old sod. She's got really grumpy recently.
Has she?
Yeah, she has. She wouldn't talk to me the other day because I was from The Sun, and that was your fault, because you did a story on the front page of The Sun, and she got really annoyed, and then she wouldn't speak to me when I went on behalf of The Sun to interview her.
I don't think
her.
She should have been annoyed about that
Who
story.
Does she think she is? No, you were quoting an interview verse from 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Who knew that being famous made people made people up their own backsides? Anyway, this is Body on Me featuring Chris Brown by Rita Ora, and it's 10:45 on Foobar Radio.
Just imagine.
Something amusing just happened in the studio, but Jen's had to shoot off. I won't say why it's happened, but she's had to shoot off. But the book, her book, Rita, about Rita Ora, is out now in bookshops. And thank you for coming in, Jen. I'm still here with Matt Lorenzo. It's 10:49 on FUBAR Radio. Matt chose some stories that he wanted to talk about, which we were going to talk about with Jen, but Jen's now shot off. But Jenny Jones, another Jen, she's been replaced by Jenny Jones, who is the Green Party peer, who's outside waiting, and she's going to be in after 11. Matt, some of the stories that you want to talk about. I've been thrown slightly by Jen having to rush out of the studio there.
Oh, don't worry. Well, I've got a few here to get us through. Start off with the Kardashians. Who the hell are the Kardashians? Who cares? Obviously, people do.
They do.
I don't know who. Well, I know who they are. They're completely made up. They're fake. And so they don't really qualify as news. But their fashion tips apparently are hot to trot.
But you love the Mail Online, right?
I read the Mail Online.
So you must be a big fan of Kardashians, well, really, because they're all over it.
The thing about the Mail Online, and people probably won't remember magazines like Titbits and Rivale, it's literally that, Titbits. You read a couple of paragraphs and there's lots of it, and there's, you know, eye candy, and I do like it. And I like, as I say, getting annoyed by the comments. And the Kardashians are a regular feature. And that thing that goes down the right on the Mail Online, which is full of celebrities.
And it's the most popular bit.
It's the most popular. I'm fairly sure people pay to be in it as well. So it's a great money spinner for
you, know,
the Mail.
I mean, as a freelance journalist, it's the Mail Online is tricky for anybody trying to make money from freelance journalism, because they basically use a tweet or an Instagram photo, and they will base 500 words somehow, incredibly 500 words around this, and so they don't really pay for stories.
What are the rules on that? So if you murder someone or you bottle someone after a 500-mile trip because they wrote something nasty about your book, they can take your picture off Facebook and legally use it?
No, it has to be, the Facebook page has to be open. So really, if you don't want your photo to be used by journalists, you must put your settings onto private. But Instagram is basically anybody can use. Although I suspect if you've bottled somebody, having travelled any distance, frankly, but if you're up in front of the beak, I suspect that public interest might overtake copyright issues. But I don't know that there's a public interest defence on copyright. Probably not. But I suspect also, if you've just bottled someone and you're going to prison, you're not going to be suing someone for copyright, are you? But
I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, I've had to use Facebook to help with a social media thing for the film, but the photograph is of my son when he was 5, and my birth date, I've moved to 2002. It's no one's bloody business that I was born before the war, is it? I mean,
you never were. You're a young slip of a man, Matt.
Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War. So yeah, these Kardashians, they recorded 2 days ago, they recorded the song for their mum, Kris Jenner, who's 60, I think. Should we have a little listen to it? It's quite a wonder.
She's 60, riding down the highway with her friends at her side. Her life without them wouldn't be complete. They are her joy and pride. She's learned a lot from all her good friends about turning 60. She's the first to reach that stop.
I think Madonna's safe.
Oh, it's amazing that there are chipmunk Kardashians as well now. They're spreading out into the gerbil family.
Did you you're probably too old. Did you ever watch the chipmunks? I used to love the chipmunks.
No.
Your kids probably watch the chipmunks.
Possibly.
How old are your kids?
Not in my presence. Well, They are 15 and 19 now.
Oh, no, they were too young, you see. It was right in my era. Anyway, that's enough of that, my. yeah, that's the Kardashians, and I think their mum probably would have preferred socks, but there you go. Mm. They won't be making X Factor anytime soon, but one person who's been involved in the X Factor, and this is a very tenuous link, but I'm going to use it anyway, is Alan Smith, the footballer's wife. So it's a sport link for you as well. He cheated on his X Factor dancer wife with a married mum of three who's not as attractive as the as his wife, but... which gives people hope, I suppose, that anyone can, you know, that Alan Smith, a footballer, could fancy them. But he weirdly rang her 82 times a day while he was cheating. How does anyone find the time to ring someone 82 times a day?
Well, she's a 43-year-old used car saleswoman, apparently, so she can't have been selling many cars if you've taken 82 phone calls.
And she's a mum of three, I think. Yeah. I don't know how she would have had the time to take 82 phone calls. I can understand 82 texts.
Well, I mean, it's just surprising that he married X Factor dancer Christina McMillan, and she's had time to get the story throughout the press over several days, so she must be actually heartbroken. And there are various pictures of her looking heartbroken, wearing next to nothing. It's a really tragic story.
It is a tragic story. She put a tracking device on his car, not sure what the legalities are of doing so, and also admitting that actually happened.
Yes. Good luck to her. And it's a shame that he's a footballer and we should be talking about the football. That's part of the problem with footballers now, is that they get so much money and they turn into pop stars. You can't, and because of social media and camera phones, you can't get anywhere near them. I mean, my contacts book used to be full of current footballers who I could talk to, get stories from, and who could trust me. But you can't get near them.
Do you find, do you genuinely find that's the case? We've had Mark Pugh, the Bournemouth player, on my show here before. I'm a Bournemouth fan. So, and he's quite sort of nice and accessible, but I to be fair, I haven't spoken to him since we've got into the Premier League. So that probably says it all.
It's difficult. And a lot, you find that they don't need to speak to you. And also, but you know, they're not as worldly wise as the rest of the human race, because they've gone from schoolboys to clubs and been looked after and don't have to take their passports when they travel abroad and stuff. And I find that they don't need you in their early 20s. Around about 28, 29, they develop personalities because they're sort of looking to punditry elsewhere, or it's no longer running a pub, is it? There's another documentary made in that. There's two facets to a footballer's life. Imagine being called in at 18, thinking you're going to be in the first team and being told, sorry, we're going to have to let you go. How do you cope with that? And then if you make it, and you have to retire at 32, 33, that is the end of your life, effectively. Even if you've got millions in the bank, how do you cope with that psychologically? I know people won't have much sympathy, but it's a genuine story.
And there's been a story in the papers just the last few days about how they've invested in, footballers have invested in certain schemes that have then fallen down. Yeah. You do wonder how footballers like David James, who must have been paid ridiculous amounts of money over his career, can end up bankrupt. But I suppose they're advised badly. Guy. I mean, even David James, he was a smart guy, wasn't he?
I think they're preyed upon generally by people with the financial interests at heart, and the good agents are few and far between. A good agent will work very well for a footballer and even be, you know, trustworthy, not so much trustworthy, but fair with a club, but most of them ain't.
I quite like Alan Smith because he played lower leagues. Do you know what I mean? He didn't just go, right, that's it, I'm retiring, I've played for, you know, Newcastle, Leeds, I'm going to, Man United, I'm going to just retire now. He clearly loves football. It's like Joe Cole playing for, who is it he's playing for now? He's Coventry.
Well, I don't know that Joe Cole would you know, have gone lower league or to as many different clubs as early had he had the choice. I mean, I think that's one of the great wasted talents, but that's pretty dull. But I think, you know, with Alan, the lovely thing about Alan Smith is I saw a documentary on him when he was playing for England schoolboys, and he was crying himself to sleep because he didn't like being away from mummy and daddy. I mean, that's real. That's heartfelt. I prefer that to going out with 43-year-old used car salesman.
But there are too many players. All the players now that you see are shining. Jamie Vardy's one. Charlie Austin's another. A lot of them have played, you know, some of the Bournemouth players that we've got, a lot of them played in non-league.
Yeah.
So they sort of came up the tough way. And there's a case to be made that, you know, these kids at 17, 18 are getting £5,000 a week contracts. What's the point in, you know, in their mind, you know, I've made it. And they haven't.
That is part of the argument I always put to managers nowadays. I mean, you go to the dressing room and you've got 11 limited companies and multimillionaires staring back at you. So what's the incentive for them to listen to you? The only argument against that is that they play for the shirt and they actually still enjoy playing football. But you ask Jose Mourinho about losing the dressing room, and I'm sure if you were honest, you'd say other factors come into play.
Matt Lorenzo, my co-presenter there, more of him in a bit. We've got Jenny Jones, the Green Party peer, who's come in for a little chat, and we'll be talking to her in a second. Matt was telling me that he listens every this is more, he's more on the money in terms of new music than I am, and he listens every week to Spotify's new releases, and this is one of them, isn't it? This is Sin Cane. I've never even heard of him, mate.
Well, I had not heard of him. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I do rather like this track.
It's How We Be, and this is Fubar Radio at 10:58. We'll be right back. Hello, it's 11:02. It's with me, Tom Latcham, and my co-presenter for the day, Matt Lorenzo. I'm pleased to say we're joined in the studio by Jenny Jones. We'll come to her very shortly, but coming up later, we've got a business section and a bit of sport with Matt Lorenzo, who is a sports presenting legend, so he's got plenty to say. But yeah, as I say, we're with Jenny Jones. There's never a dull moment where Jenny is concerned, and I mean that, in a nice way. Absolutely, in the nicest possible way. She's very outspoken. She's always getting herself into some kind of scrape. In fact, she was in a scrape just last week on Question Time. But Jenny Jones is the sole House of Lords peer for the Green Party. She's also represented the Greens in the London Assembly since it was created in 2000. She was Green candidate for the Mayor of London in 2012, coming third. And she previously served as Deputy Mayor of London in the early 2000s. Hello, welcome.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you. And hopefully you can be as fun and outspoken as usual on this show too.
I'll do my best.
We were just talking about the Green Party's performance at the last election. You got 1.15 million votes. Was that? I mean, that was more than ever. I believe. Is that correct?
It was. But I was hoping for more. I've got to say, I was very much hoping we might get another MP. Because quite honestly, it's great having one MP. She's absolutely amazing. But having two, can you imagine what we could do with two when we've done so much with one?
Well, you did, and you were hoping that you might get at least three. Is that correct? In Bristol,
yes.
And the other place where in Norfolk was it or somewhere?
Yes, like that. And it looked good at first. And then, of course, I think a lot of people, you know, just decided they would go with their usual vote. It's a shame.
How can you improve that then? I mean, as I say, we were talking just off mic. And actually, do you think you've got a thankless task until PR comes in? And actually, will it ever come in, proportional representation? Because it doesn't suit the winners, the current government.
I'm not sure it doesn't suit the Tories and Labour these days. I think it actually could suit them to have some sort of PR. The fact is, we do get people elected under the current system. It's really tough, but we do. We get councillors and one MP. And so, and of course, Assembly members. Big elections coming up in London next year. Mm-hmm. And we really, really hope to get not just the two we've had for years now, but at least one more and possibly, four. That would be amazing.
How do you think Natalie Bennett's getting on as leader? We had her on the show a little while ago. I thought she did quite well in that interview. She hasn't done so well in some other interviews. How do you think she's getting on and got on?
It's starting to really annoy me, actually, the fact that people do mention the fact she didn't do particularly well in one or two interviews. The fact is, she has done thousands and thousands of interviews. She has single-handedly slogged up and down Britain, talking to small groups of people, big groups of people, done lots and lots of interviews. I'm a big fan of hers. I think she's fantastic. And we owe a big chunk of the green surge that we had before the general election to her because she's done such a good job.
Was it a mistake putting her up in King's Cross against Keir Starmer, who was, you know, head and shoulders likely to win that seat?
Well, you say putting up. The Green Party's got democratic procedures, and so she
that
stood...
That doesn't sound very like modern-day politics.
Well, she stood against, you know, she was selected by the members of her local party to be the candidate there.
Okay. And if you became Prime Minister, it's not going to happen because you... various reasons. If you were Prime Minister, what would be the one policy that you would bring in now to change Britain?
I suppose I would change our economic policy because the fact is it's not working at the moment. There's all this talk about austerity, but in fact, of course, if you want to reinvigorate an economy, what you need to do is make sure that there's energy at the bottom, that people who work and people who want to work actually can do it and earn a living that they can build a life on and not just sort of end up borrowing or you know, having to rely on benefits. Nobody wants to live like that.
No, well, I mean, Labour have been opposing them, and you yourself in the House of Lords voted against those measures, which was an interesting time. Many people said it was unconstitutional.
There's quite a tussle for Greens like us because, of course, the Lords is unelected, it's all appointed, it's a lot of it is cronies and so on. I personally was selected by my party. We had one member, one vote, and we had a list, and I came top of the list. So I feel I'm no less appointed than any of the others, but at least I did get a vote somewhere. But the fact is, sometimes it works, the House of Lords, and this is one occasion with the tax credit cuts where it blocked them that it really did work. I was proud to be in the Lords, and I've never said that before.
Really? And what do you see as the future for the Lords? I mean, obviously, this was the first time they'd ever done this. People saying that this is what they were for. Some people saying this is what they were for. Some people saying it was unconstitutional.
It was absolutely not unconstitutional. It was constitutional and it was legal. There is no doubt about that. The government's made a big play about how it's wrong. If the government had wanted to bring it through, they could have done it through the House of Commons properly, had a proper debate, and then we would not have been able to vote it down in the way that we did. You mentioned PR and nobody having a real appetite for proportional representation, but the fact is the government's threatening to do something to the House of Lords. Green Party policy is to scrap it, to bring it in all elected. I'd be the first person to support them if they decided to do that.
Even though it meant you'd lose all your money.
You'd lose all your perks,
£380 a day or whatever it is you guys get.
It's 300, but you know what? It'd be worth it because, quite honestly, although, as I said before, it does function, it functions in a weird way, the fact is it would be so much better if it were a democratic house and it would have more legitimacy.
Do you think that will happen?
You know, it could. There could be tweaks. I sat next to somebody in the House of Lords yesterday and said, and turned to her and said, you know, I think we're going to die before the government changes the House of Lords. Everybody agrees it should be changed, but the Tories didn't
until it played against them.
Well, quite, yes. but nobody can agree a way forward. The fact is, though, it's normal for the opposition in the House of Lords to have a majority. It's only in the last government, the coalition government, where the Lib Dems always voted with the Tories, that the government had a majority. So it's normal to have a lot of opposition. And there's a lot of expertise in the House of Lords, people who really know their stuff. And so the amendments that are put are often superb and make things better.
And how do you think Jeremy Corbyn is getting on? There could be sort of an argument that he's stolen some of your votes by moving, you know, hard to the left, which is obviously, you know, where you are placed on the political spectrum a lot of the time.
I've been asking around our local parties and a few people have left, but at the same time we've had more come in, so it's really difficult for me at the moment to say whether or not he's had a big impact. I'm a fan of Jeremy Corbyn. I like him, I respect him, and I just think some of his sort of behaviour is quite old-fashioned and courteous, and I very much like that. It's time that all those sheep in the House of Commons, you know, stopped buying and behaved like adults.
Do you genuinely think he can lead a proper, strong opposition, given his background and his performance since he became leader?
I think it's difficult to lead opposition anyway, because when you're out of power, you feel powerless and you get angry and you get thwarted and so on. So he's got a tough job, but at the same time, why not? Different style, you know, he might actually make the Labour Party, I was going to say, a happier place to be. I mean, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Well, he's getting a rough ride from the media. Do you think he's bringing some of that on himself? What I don't understand about his rough ride from the media, particularly The Sun, right? So The Sun is a Conservative-supporting paper. We all know that. In fact, until fairly recently, when Tony Gallagher took over, it was pretty much the mouthpiece for the government. So you would think that by keeping Corbyn in there, and given his inability to lead his own party, let alone any kind of credible opposition, it would make sense for them to go, oh, no, we quite like Jeremy Corbyn. Stay there, mate. You know, because at the moment, we'll be in for the next... The Tories will be in for the next 10, 15 years. So
it's almost as if they can't help themselves, isn't it? You know? But I think all the criticism from The Sun is actually helping him, as you've just suggested, it's helping him massively, because it's making moderate people think, oh, you know, not bowing enough? That's absolutely ridiculous. You know, he bowed.
How long do you see him lasting, genuinely?
I think there's a question about whether he not wants to be Prime Minister. Mm. I think that's, you know, it may or may not suit him, and it's down for him to decide. He might want to pull the party together, move it a bit to the left, and then let somebody else through, or he might find he's really enjoying himself and he'll stay. So
a masochist or not is the question.
It is hard. It's hard for him. He's got a long, hard job.
But are you worried that, you know, given that Cameron is bringing in a lot of things that you guys are opposing more so in many ways than Labour, that actually there is effectively no opposition, and what that means for our democracy?
That has been a problem. I've seen it in the Lords and I've seen it in the Commons, that there hasn't been any sort of concerted opposition since the general election. I think that's damaging for everybody, because if a government isn't challenged and made to rethink sometimes, then we can't get the best for the country. I mean, personally, I think this government is, they are a bunch of barbarians. They are vandals. They are tearing apart all sorts of very important social systems, you know, the NHS, the railways, and of course, their whole plan around climate change, the environment. Well, they haven't got a plan, but they seem to be thwarting everything that all the best advice suggests they should do.
Obviously, the thing that you guys voted down was the cuts to working tax credits, yeah. which you many people said that, you know, many millions of people will be worse off under it, even though they're raising the living wage or whatever, you know, whatever they will say. How do you see that playing out as an issue?
It's obviously they're going to do it somehow if they possibly can.
But it's making them very unpopular. Can you see this potentially being their poll tax moment?
I'd like to think that, but you know, Labour has bought into this whole austerity story, which was a big mistake, I think. And so it's going to take, I think, even more than that to turn people around. I mean, one thing that's obviously upsetting a lot of people that, you know, who are on my side of things is the whole dropping of subsidies for solar and wind when they're still putting subsidies into fossil fuels and nuclear. Now, most people, when they look at that, they think, hold on, well, it's all right to drop subsidies if you drop subsidies for everything, but dropping it just for some of the things and actually some of the things that are better for us as a country, that just seems barking mad. So I'm hoping that it'll be a combination of things that would teach people it's wrong to vote Tory.
And do you think you describe them as barbarians? What do you think David Cameron's legacy will be? I mean, particularly compared to Thatcher, whom he so adores.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping he won't be around as long as Thatcher, of course. So it's very. I mean, one of the things that politics has taught me is that you can't, you know, it's tough to guess right about it. So it's wrong to make predictions, I think. Well, for me.
Would you have joined the Green Party if you could have predicted the future?
I joined the Green Party so long ago, and I never had any ambitions apart from, you know, making a planet fit for my kids, and now, of course, fit for my grandkids. So that's my ambition for the Green Party. There's something of the planet left for them.
Okay, well, we'll play one of your songs now, and we'll come back and talk a bit more about some of your, because you're an expert on housing, you're an expert on transport. Got some questions on those. We'll come back. This is Jenny Jones here on Fubar Radio. I'm Tom Latcham, and it's 11:15. I'm also with Matt Lorenzo, who's just been sort of quietly nodding along sometimes.
Listening.
Engaged. Anyway, this is Nina Simone, My Baby Just Cares For Me.
My baby don't care for shows. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me. My baby don't care for cars and races. My baby don't care for hot dog and places. Liz Taylor is not a star, and even Lana Turner's smile, something he can't see. My baby don't care, who knows? My baby just cares for me. blows. He cares for me. My baby don't care for cars and races. Baby don't care for. He don't care for high-toned places. Liz Taylor is not the style. And even Liberace's smile. Something he can't see. Something he can't see. I wonder what's wrong with baby. My baby just cares for. My baby just cares for. My baby just cares for me.
Tom Latcham here with Matt Lorenzo, my co-presenter for the day, who might say something at some point during this section, who knows.
I don't have much to offer, actually. I would say that I filled out a form. It was an online thing before the last election where you, what do you think of, tick for these policies, do you agree with this? And I'm a Green supporter, apparently.
I know, you see, there is a website that you can do this on. I think Vote for Policies or something. We come way above the other parties. We talk so much sense.
Well, you would say that.
And it looks straight face.
You're an expert in the field of transport and housing. I've got a policy for you that you can take if you'd like.
Well, tell me.
OK. So, obviously, you served on the chair of the London Food, Green Transport and Road Safety Ambassador, etc., etc. In June, it was reported that nearly £100 million of passengers' money was lying unused on dormant Oyster cards. Mm. £46.6 million of deposits and credit of £53 million. I was thinking, well, I mean, it's scandalous that they just sit on this money making so much interest when it's money that's, you know, lapsed or whatever. Should it not be used to subsidise the travel of key workers who can't afford to live in London because of the housing crisis?
You see, it's a good idea. There's two things wrong with it. First of all,
no.
I mean, you know, it could be a good idea. First of all, you've got to understand the ebb and flow on those cards. I mean, it might be a sort of quite fixed amount, but you might find some of it lies dormant for 30 days a month, and it's used the other day.
No. This is cards that have been not used for a year, which is at what point you lose the money. So it's
you
money.
Lose that, money.
The money.
No,
it's
hold on, because I've got some at home that I use for guests who come.
But they use it more than once a year. If you don't use it for a year, you lose your money.
Wow.
So that TfL's
right,
sitting on £100 million.
Okay.
And I think that, like, particularly given the housing crisis, so we're increasingly moving to a Parisian style city of London, whereby the rich live in the middle and the poor can't afford it, and then
well,
they
that's
travel
exactly
in.
That's my other point about your idea. The fact is, we shouldn't be driving people out of the city. We should.
But they are.
Well,
I mean, they are being driven.
People like the Mayor of London and councils, local councils in London, could do something about that, and they should do something about it. I've totally given up with Boris, obviously, because he's been his mind's well, and his body's been elsewhere for most of this year, and he's not going to do anything radical in the next few months. But the new mayor, that's a big opportunity, and we should be lobbying the top candidates now for all, you know, if there's any NGOs out there who want things from the next mayor, we should be getting these things into their manifestos.
Have you done your manifesto yet? It's not been released yet.
It's not released.
You can have that one. Have a look into it. It's something that's worth looking
at. I will pass the idea on to the people who are doing it.
Maybe I can come and work in the policy department of the Green Party. Do they pay well? I don't know.
Well, we definitely pay always a living wage, and we've got good people. We probably don't have high pay compared with other places. Can I just dispute something you said? You said I'm an expert in housing, an expert in transport. I'm not an expert. I just have strong views, and that is a bit different.
Yeah, but you've served on panels you know, boards that are in those areas. So I would say you are an expert in the way that you might call me, you're a former TV editor of the News of the World. I'm an expert on the X Factor. I mean, I'm not, but you know, I would be billed as such, you know, so... You can dispute if you want, but
I have a lot of views. It's true.
You brought in a lot of, or you were certainly part of the idea to bring in 20-mile-per-hour zones in London, right?
Yeah.
I've got a bit of beef with that.
Go on.
There's no point in having 20 mile per hour zones at night. And I travel once a week to do a paper review on a radio station at 3 a.m, and I have to drive through Islington at 20 miles an hour. There's no one on the roads. There's no one around. It's completely pointless. Is there not something in that? Why do we need 20 miles per hour zones at night?
I think that it is safer to have one rule that everybody understands. So I disagree with you.
Would you like to see 20 mile per hour zones rolled out in all cities across the UK? Would that be your idea?
I would like to see it as far as Inverness or whatever the top of Scotland is. Yeah, of course I would. Of course. It saves lives. I mean, you've got no idea of the difference.
But you know, in Inverness, a lot of the time people don't need to drive at 20 miles an hour because there's no one around.
Well, you say that, but on the off chance there might be. I'm sorry.
ridiculous.
I'm sorry. No, it's much, much safer. It's safer for you as a driver as well. You could always hit, you know, a cat or a dog or, I don't know, in Inverness, a deer or something. So you could... You know, it is safer for everybody. The thing about the transport measures that the Greens are very keen on, like cycling and so on, we had a sympathetic mayor, and I think it's the one election in Britain, probably, where the personality of the person that you are electing matters so much. You know, Ken Livingstone, for all his faults, was a fantastic mayor, and I really admired him.
And Boris Johnson liked cycling. Introduce cycling. Who knew that you and Boris Johnson could be bedfellows in that way?
He talks about cycling. And he even talks as if he's a Green, but he absolutely isn't. He has not done enough for cycling. He's actually contributed to the increase in congestion that we're seeing in London at the moment, and that's not good for anybody. It's not good for the drivers stuck in the traffic. Certainly not good for the rest of us who breathe the polluted air.
The other thing that I said you're sort of an expert on it was housing, and I can't get my head around this. Why is it that no government, since Thatcher sold off all of the state housing stock, why has no government built anywhere near the number of homes that are needed to? You would think it would be a vote winner, right? And you can't say it's all red tape, because you can change the red tape, because if you're in government, that's the point. There must be a reason. Why has, for instance, Labour, why did they not build anywhere near enough houses? And now they're carping on saying, oh, you should build more houses. Well, they didn't do it for 15 years. So there must be a reason, Jenny. Is there a reason? What is the reason?
Well, you would have to get somebody from Labour in to give you a proper answer. But part of it, especially in London, is that if you can build houses on an empty site or something like that, you sell them for a huge profit. That's what, you know, councils are becoming more and more cash strapped because the government's cutting their funding all the time. They've got to make the money somewhere. So they sell off empty properties or they knock down social housing estates and put in loads of expensive flats so that they can make some money out of it. And that's exactly why people are being driven out of the centre. And these days, it's not just cleaners and nurses. It's academics and it's young doctors who are all being pushed out of London.
But as a housing expert, you must have an idea about why it's not being done. Because it's a simple vote winner as far as probably Matt and I are concerned. You know, build more houses so we can live in a house, so young people have a chance of buying a house and not having to move out of the country or paying rent that's 50-60% of their income. There must be a reason.
Housing's been a problem for a long time, but it has risen in people's awareness as a big problem. And so 10 years ago we were talking about housing being a problem, but not with the same sort of urgency that people are feeling at the moment.
What do you see as the future of cities like London in 20 years' time, 30 years' time? I mean, we've seen rents increase by a double or in 3 years in some places. My friend, rent doubled in 3 years. What do you see as the future? We can't keep going in this way, can we? And if we do, what is the future of London as an entity, as an organi- as a city?
Again, you're asking me to make predictions, and I'm useless at that. I'm almost always wrong. Rents and house prices have not always gone up in London. There have been crashes, and so that, you know, it's entirely possible it could happen again. At the moment, there's a lot of housing that is owned by offshore companies. If they suddenly decided to ditch all this housing, things could be
limiting
different.
The number of foreign like investors that are allowed to buy housing in the UK. There's no limit currently. Should we be limiting that? Should we be saying foreign investment is not allowed for X number of years?
Well, that's one option. Another option would be to start building a lot of social housing, because councils have not been able to do that, but they can now, and they should be going ahead. Social housing. It's fine to build some affordable housing as long as it's truly affordable. At the moment, as soon as the mayor came in, he whacked up the concept of affordable up to, you had to earn 65... You know, under Ken, it was you had to earn, I don't know, 35 or something. And under Boris, you have to earn 65 to get something that's affordable. We should be building social housing, truly affordable housing. And we should be limiting the number of offshore buyers.
One thing I thought is I'm lucky to get the river bus home from Embankment or somewhere to Putney, where I live. And if you travel at night, you travel past all these brand new developments that are riverside. None of the lights are on because there's no one in them. They've all, as I said, the first place that Savills will go to sell these things is Hong Kong.
Yep.
And then rich people over here get the chance to buy them. Couldn't we just make it so that if you're going to buy these things as investments, that you are forced to rent them out to people who need them while you're just using them for waiting for the bricks and mortar to be worth double?
Hmm. And with a rent cap, potentially, you know,
absolutely.
You can say, well, you know, you want to buy it, you got to live by our rules.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you on that.
Well, thanks for coming in. But finally, I wanted to ask you a question. What do you think about all these politicians that are answering all these personal questions? And you see James Cleverly, he was talking about smoking weed, talking about watching porn, that sort of thing. Do you think that that's a good thing, that politicians are being more open in that regard?
Well, I do, in the sense that if you're not open about it, you get caught out later. I've got 10 top tips, especially for women, and I think number 4 or 5 is confess your skeletons, if you've got any, because they will come out at some point. It's better you bring them out.
Do you have any remaining skeletons, Jenny Jones?
Oh, God. I really can't think of any. No, I live a moderately boring life by most people's standards. So...
John Pienaar on Five Live, he was too embarrassed to ask. So he asked James Cleverly all these questions, but he was too embarrassed to ask a female politician whether they'd ever watched porn. He said, "I didn't think women ever watched porn." So Jenny Jones, I know that this is a tough question, and I know it's perhaps not very gentlemanly of me to ask, but I'm going to ask: have you ever watched porn?
No. Although
you've never seen a porn film, never, ever, 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 ever,
never.
Oh, you talk rot, never. Matt Lorenzo.
On very early in the start of the London Assembly, a Conservative politician came into my office.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say who it was, and he said, "Look at this, look at this," and he actually pulled up some gay porn on my computer. And he said, "Look, they give us access to this," and I obviously, I didn't look.
Well, how did you know it was gay porn, Jenny Jones? I tell you what, though, Snoopers Charter, Theresa May would have known what you were watching.
Absolutely, I know. Well, that's quite scary.
But there you go.
That is going to be a big problem.
Hmm.
It looks at the moment as if the government's backed off and given us all sorts of safeguards, but I don't trust them on it, so we'll have to...
Governments always want more power, don't they?
They do.
Never trust a politician. Apart from Jenny Jones. Thank you for coming in, Jenny. It's been lovely to have you in the studio today, and it's been great fun as ever. And you were great fun. And you didn't say anything hugely controversial.
Are you disappointed?
Apart from the fact that you've never watched porn, which I in this day and age, I find that incredible. But there you go, anyway.
Perhaps I have an interesting sex life.
Oh, how interesting,
without
Jenny
porn.
Jones. thank you for coming in anyway. We'll play you out with a song, a Joni Mitchell song, and then we're going to have a business section coming up. Matt Lorenzo may or may not say anything in that section, but you know, whatever. He
taught you about porn.
We'll stay tuned, and he might well do. It's Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now. Thank you, Jenny Jones.
Everywhere I've looked at clouds that weep With Matt Haycox, in association with Access Commercial Finance, creative commercial funding.
Hello, it's Tom Latcham. It's 11:36, and joining me, as always, is FUBAR's radio business expert, Matt Haycox. This week, he'll be discussing. I'm also with Matt Lorenzo, who's been telling me some interesting. He told me his porn story, basically, which is we won't name the person, but he incriminates one of his former colleagues as being a prolific porn watcher. So.
Yeah, there you go.
We'll leave you thinking that who that might be. Don't leave it dangling anywhere,
no,
Matt.
It wasn't dangling.
But I'm with Matt Haycox as well.
How you doing?
Hello, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
How was the train from Leeds?
I knew you were going to ask me, and the good news is I wasn't in trouble today.
Oh, well, that's good.
I did speak very quietly on my phone, but...
Well, that's good. I got the train from Leeds just the other day. I went up to an Emmerdale press event.
Oh, yeah?
And on my carriage was... No, none other than Ed Miliband, two seats away, in the second class, you know, cattle class or whatever, which I thought was good. And he wanted to do some work, but then he had to do loads of selfies with people, and so you kind of see, the benefit of him going in first class. But then he gets criticised. But actually, he's like, "Yeah, but I can't get any bloody work done because of all you people." But he was dragged off to the bar by a couple of young, older ladies, and they were like, "Come on, we'll buy you a beer." And he's like, I don't really want a beer." And he came back and did selfies, and then he was talked to some guy who was sat opposite, had a selfie, he was working for some business, and he was like, "Oh, so who do you work for? What's that company? Then what do they do?" And you're just thinking, you don't care. But it's but it's interesting, that he still.
That's like you when engages. You're talking to me.
Who do you work for, Matt? Who do you work for? Matt's going to be discussing the next stage in creating a company, development and pitching and that sort of
talking
stuff.
Talking about the big pitch.
Exactly. Have you pitched much in your career? done much pitching. I've always hated it. I'm rubbish at it.
Yeah, I have, and I still do to a degree. You know, whether I'm pitching for myself or pitching for businesses that I'm involved in or helping out with. I'd say I watch a lot more pitches than I actually do now. I went to quite a good pitching session last week in Manchester. I normally get a list of attendees beforehand because I only like to look at businesses that I can relate to or feel I can add value to. But this was quite an interesting list, so I went down. Although the second one was specialist clothing for menopausal, specialist night clothing for menopausal women.
Well, so, you're big on that, aren't you?
That is one I had to step away from.
You didn't invest in that one?
I didn't.
But was it a good pitch?
Yeah, it was a good pitch. You know, the lady who did it was very convincing. And if I had an interest in how much women sweated during the menopausal evening, I would be I would be giving her my cash. But
although menopausal women obviously sometimes can be
not sweaty,
tricksy. It can be tricksy, so I don't know if you'd want to go into business with a menopause. I don't know. Anyway, when you are doing a pitch in front of potential investors, what is it that you should be thinking about?
I mean, for me, it's all about kind of clarity and conciseness. Going back to these kind of pitching events, what I like about them is you have to be done in 5 minutes, 10 minutes tops. If you can't get across in a very short space of time, what your business is doing, then I think you've got a problem. You've got to be able to make your investor understand. I suppose going back to the stereotypical elevator pitch. For me, that's 90% of the battle.
What's an elevator pitch?
Doing a pitch in an elevator. You get in the ground floor, you get out of the top, and have you been able to tell a random stranger what your business is?
It depends what elevator it is, because I used to work at Canary Wharf. They did add loads of time. It took like ages to get up there. But just hear it through by radio.
You'd have to be really
no
quick,
time
right?
at all.
You've got to be able to get it across in a short space of time, and you've really got to know your numbers, know your facts. And for me, I think, explain what you want to explain in 3 to 5 minutes, but then be ready to answer any question that anyone's going to throw at you, because you've got to know that business inside out. You've got to have a complete handle on the figures and be able to answer anything that's thrown at you.
How important is appearance in that? Would you ever invest in someone if they looked scruffy?
Well, you are talking.
Would you invest in me? I've got a dirty t-shirt on. I accidentally put a dirty t-shirt on this morning.
I actually wore shoes for the first time in about 2 months last week, so I know how you feel. I mean, look, I think my advice for that is you just have to use common sense. I mean, I think we're a much more casual society than we were 5 years, 10 years, 15 years ago, whatever. But at the end of the day, you're still asking someone to part with the cash. So whilst you might not be in a 3-piece suit, I probably don't think it's advisable to turn up in your shorts and t-shirt either.
And if you've got some funding, is it a good idea to seek external funding? I mean, we were talking to Matt Lorenzo about he's. Got a movie. He's creating a movie about Bobby Moore currently, and Matt has got money from investors.
But mainly, it's an EIS scheme,
which
offers tax advantages if you've got a few bob, and you get 30% back generally, and even more if you're the first to go in. But it is difficult, funny enough, to get people to part with their money. I find the richer they are, the more difficult it is. But some, it takes 5 minutes and you've got the money the next day. And others, they want to know chapter and verse, which is not my forte. You have to hand them over to the accountant part. But basically, my experience is you have to keep kissing frogs or headbutting the wall.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing is finding the right people to talk to, because, and I completely agree with what you say, that some people you can talk to and they come back and forth and back and forth, and in my experience, they're not really people who are ever going to part with the money anyway. I think the people who are high caliber experienced investors who actually they want to spend money, you don't have to drag it out of them if they want to give it. And I think so it's a matter of, I suppose, being steered around those frogs so you can kiss the right ones and do it quicker.
Yeah. And did you have frogs for me then?
Did you have to pitch, Matt, or was it more of a casual?
I found out it's mostly me, because people know what I do and my connection with the film, and I buy, just speaking from the heart, I can sell it. I don't think I'm selling it, I'm just telling them what I'm up to.
But was it an official pitch, or was it more of a, you'd have a casual?
No, I don't go and stand in front of people. I wouldn't really like, I could do it, but that all sounds a bit like The Apprentice to me. I'd rather, if someone's interested, go see them.
And when Matt Haycox, when you are pitching, what should you be including in said pitch? Obviously, you've just said you haven't got much time, so you need to make it concise, but what are the things that you need to be including?
First of all, obviously, a quick summary of what the business is. You know, what are you doing? What are you selling? What are you going to achieve? Definitely who you are. You know, what is going to make you be able to run that business and do a better job than someone else was doing? Who's your audience? How are you going to market to them? What are the brief headline economics of the business? So if we're selling a widget, how much are we buying it for? How much are we going to spend on it? And what are we going to sell it for? And then really, if you're talking to an investor, how much do you need? How are you going to spend their money? And how are they going to get a return on that? Because, you know, ultimately, you know, that is all the investors is interested in. You know, what is their exit route? Is it going to be dividends? Is it going to be a sale? And I think, you know, the key is to be realistic.
In what regard?
Well, I suppose in every regard, but you know, particularly when it comes down to the valuation of your business. I mean, I've seen, you know, so many great businesses. I'm sure you guys have, you know, on TV shows like, you know, Dragon's Den, Shark Tank, etc. You know, you see guys there who've got a great business who could really go somewhere with it, but they're so deluded about the valuation from the beginning that they just make it, you know, a completely uninvestable proposition.
And I've been asked to ask this, but I don't actually know what it is, so you have to explain it to me too. What's an accelerator academy?
An accelerator academy. It kind of is what it says on the tin, you know. It's like a mentoring program, so as a business, you could take part in an accelerator academy where you'll get access to recruitment advice, to lawyers, to solicitors, to mentors. You know, other people who've been there and done it. You can, you know, network with like-minded businesses. It's really, you know, kind of throwing everything into one room that, you know, that could take you, you know, months and months and years to get through, and they'll, you know, they'll be there to help you in kind of, you know, 6 to 12 weeks. I mean, it's particularly suitable to, you know, to startup businesses, high growth businesses, and, you know, a lot of tech companies go in them.
Okay, cool. Let's play a song and we'll be back after this. This is one of Matt Lorenzo's choices, I think. Stevie Nicks, was that one of your choices, Matt?
Yeah, I like this one.
Okay, this is Has Anyone Ever Written Anything For You by Stevie Nicks. It's Fubo Radio, it's 11:45, and hopefully I press the right button this time.
It was easy to say, I believed in you. If not for me, then do it for the world.
Fubar Radio.
Hello, it's Tom Latcham here with Matt Lorenzo.
Still playing.
Stevie, she's a white witch.
It's gone to minus 13 for some reason, that Matt Lorenzo song there. Stevie Nicks, and I'm still with Matt Haycox and Matt Lorenzo. Continuing our business section, on the line now is David Powell. Whilst living in Manchester, David and friends were sharing flat 304 in the city centre. That is important, that number. When a business idea was born to start a clothing company. Since then, his company, which is 304 Clothing, has gone from strength to strength, selling clothes around the globe and expanding their fledgling empire. And he joins us now on the line. Hello, mate.
Hi there, how you doing, mate?
I'm okay, how are you?
Not too bad at all, a little bit busy, but it's good to talk to you.
Well, I think that's probably a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
As someone who's running the business, it's better to be busy than not, I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Can't complain.
So tell us about your clothing company and how it came about and that sort of stuff.
Well, as you said, really, it's myself and a friend from university. We moved to Manchester from Liverpool. Moved into flat 304, and then essentially we just, out of boredom, started making clothes for a Parklife Festival in Manchester. We had a bit of an after party, and then people stole the clothes out of our flat, so we essentially sold out without getting any money, and it just went from there.
David, I was particularly interested actually when I heard that you were coming on today, because I've been looking at three or four clothing related businesses over the last few weeks who were looking at fundraising, and I suppose you could certainly say that clothing's a saturated market insofar as if we never got another clothing label again, I'm sure none of us would be naked. But how do you set yourselves apart in a saturated market? You know, what makes you different? Who's your customer, and how are you targeting them?
I think fortunately we started about 3 years ago when social media, Instagram and things like that, businesses weren't using it as much, so we're sort of at the forefront with a lot of other businesses that are doing it now. You can obviously pay to promote and things like that, but at the time it was free, so we made use of social media to grow an organic following, and it just went from strength to strength, and now we're at the stage where we can experiment a little bit more. It was unisex to start with, so we could appeal to both men and women with one product, and we're starting to get away from that now where we've got specific women products, specific men products, and just diversifying really.
Do you just sell online, or have you made it into any stores?
Yeah, we for the past 3 years pretty much has been e-commerce, online, building the brand up, and then over the past 6 months we started to approach wholesale market really and try and get in stores. In England, America, Holland, Europe, just getting the wheels going on that really, on the wholesale side of things, but we will be in a lot of shops pretty soon.
And tell me, one of the guys here was saying that you get your clothing, it's been featured on a couple of the reality shows and things. I mean, is that something where you see a direct correlation, in a short space of time to, someone wearing one of your shirts and the website starts buzzing?
Yeah, it has a massive impact when you see people from Made in Chelsea and Towies wearing your clothes and things. It's people follow them now, and they're starting to make their own clothing brands because they can see such potential and impact they have, really. So, yeah, last week, we were online, and our website obviously peaked massively in terms of sales and hits as a result, which is great for us.
What sort of clothes is it? How would you describe your clothes?
It's casual sportswear really, so you can take inspiration from people like Superdry, Jack Wills,
people like Tom. Dogs,
it's the sort of thing, I'm looking at the website now, it's I could see footballers wearing it.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't mind some footballers getting older.
You should probably that might be an idea, right? So get a footballer out on the town in Manchester with all their sort of wag. That'd be a great way of pushing it, right? Getting on Mail Online, that sort of stuff.
Oh yeah, it'd be brilliant. Yeah, a few footballers, few friends of friends have got hold of stuff, but they're a little bit more reserved in terms of shouting about wearing people's clothes. But they do knock about in it from time to time.
They're so reserved, footballers, aren't they?
Yeah, they don't.
How have you done your product placement before? You know, you mentioned the Towie and the Made in Chelsea people. Do you work with kind of, you know, placement agents for that, or is that just, you know, stuff you've been able to do from batting the telephone?
Telephone, really. Just because we obviously try to keep as much of the jobs in house, as much of the money in house, really, rather than having to pay agents and things like that. So we tend to do it ourselves through social media, Twitter, and things like that. And then just through friends of friends, someone always knows someone who knows someone that you can just chuck them a t-shirt and hope for the best, really.
David, can we have some freebies?
Yeah, I can sort you out a few freebies, yeah.
That sounds good to me, mate. Especially Will, the producer, he's positively celebrating back there. I mean, I think it's because his clothes are getting a bit old and he hasn't got any money, so that'll be good for him. You'll be thanking Will Brazier, the producer, not naked, thanks to 304 Clothing.
Brilliant, I'll sort Will out.
Top man. Listen, thank you for joining us, matey.
Cheers, David.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me. Cheers.
Thank you. That was David Powell, who's... he and his friends have created 304 Clothing in Manchester. You can get to the website 304clothing.com. Matt Haycox, thanks for coming in again.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to go and go out of the town, are we? No?
We certainly are. We can talk about me picking a song for next week as well. I've had to listen to everyone else as well.
That sounds fair to me. And Matt Lorenzo, thank you for joining me today. Your new film, what's it? Is it a working title? Is it got a title yet?
It's called Bobby. But
it's called Bobby. I suspect it probably won't change, right?
B-O-6-6-Y is the clever
one. That's very clever. Mm. And it's out in May, did you say? Right. And what are your hopes for that movie? Do you think it'll be as big as Ronaldo?
Oh, I think it's a better subject than Ronaldo, so hopefully we'll do it justice.
And are you voicing it?
No, it's in the centre model, so it tells its own story.
Right, okay. Well, I can look forward to that. I can't wait to see it. Thanks to all my guests today. Matt Lorenzo there, author and journalist Jem Wiley, who did the papers but had to escape for reasons unbeknown. Green Party peer Jenny Jones admitted she'd never watched porn apart from a gay porno that a Tory MP showed her. I'm going to try and get to the bottom of that off air. I think, excuse the pun there. And Business with Matt Haycox. Coming up at 4 p.m. is Doc Brown and Hugh Joseph with the Tuesday Roundup. You can download my interviews as a podcast from iTunes and SoundCloud, particularly that Jenny Jones one. I'll see you all next week. Play out with that's pretty much a song at the moment. Hello by Adele. It's Football Radio. I'm Tom Latcham. Cheers very much. Bye.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all these years you'd like to meet, to go over everything. They say the time's supposed to heal ya, but I ain't done much healing. Hello, can you hear me? I'm in California dreaming about who we used to be when we were younger and free. I've forgotten how it felt before the world fell at our feet. There's such a difference between us and a million miles. Hello from the other side. I must have called a thousand times to tell you I'm sorry for everything that I've done. But when I call, you never seem to be home. Hello from the outside.
typical of me to talk about myself. I'm sorry. I hope that you're well. Did you ever make it out of that town where nothing ever happened? It's no secret that the both of us are running.